the company. Ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again.
Welcome to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is podcast program number 40. We're moving right along with over 22,000 downloads, exceeding the expectations of many. I am your host, Bob O'Connor. We are broadcasting from the podcast studio of Radio Heart Media from room 205 in the Good Building, 113 West Liberty Street in Charlestown, West Virginia. Logistically, the podcast will post each week on Thursday afternoon. It is available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. I have the remarkable pleasure of traveling this great country and meeting new people at various locations and lecturing about my books. A recent escapade took me to Watervliet, New York, where I got to spend some time with a fine group belonging to the Albany Civil War Roundtable. I also frequently meet descendants of the characters of my book. A recent talk at the Renfrew Museum in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, brought me in contact with a direct descendant of Harriet Lane, who was First Lady in Washington when her uncle James Buchanan was president. If your group or organization is looking for a speaker, give me a shout at my website, www.BobOConnorBooks.com. My schedule still has some dates open for 2018 if you hurry. You are listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. My special guest today is Dr. Craig Simons. Dr. Simons is a distinguished visiting Ernest J. King Professor of Maritime History at the U.S. Naval War College and Professor Emeritus at the United States Naval Academy, where he taught naval and Civil War history for 30 years. He is the author of numerous books, both on Civil War navies and on Abraham Lincoln. Welcome, Dr. Simons.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Could you give us a little bit more specific background on yourself?
Sure. I'm a native Californian, which is about as far away as you can get from Civil War battlefields and still be in the continental United States. But I have been fascinated with Civil War issues and topics since I was a boy, and with naval issues since I read C.S. Forrester's collection of books on the fictional Horatio Hornblower. So Civil War history and naval history have been particular interests of mine for many years. I'm a graduate of UCLA. I have graduate degrees from the University of Florida and, of course, lived in Annapolis, Maryland for almost 50 years, working on naval history there. I have recently become more interested in World War II and have done a number of books on World War II as well, including the Battle of Midway and D-Day, and most recently, World War II at Sea, which is out just last month. But the Civil War remains a special interest of mine, so I'm glad to have an opportunity to talk with you about it.
I actually spoke at the Naval Academy, and you'll get a kick out of this. I spoke on a Friday night, and I was impressed that all the first-year students came out to see me instead of going on dates, and then they told me afterwards that they don't get to go on dates on Friday nights, so they go to lectures.
If only they hadn't told you that.
I know.
Great gratification.
I know. Oh, well. Annapolis is a beautiful place, that's for sure.
It is.
Of all your expertise, sir, I would like to have you talk about the Civil War navies, something that I would not think that many Civil War buffs know a whole lot about. Can you start with what the two navies looked like at the start of the war in April of 1861?
Sure. You know, one of the fascinating things about the American Civil War is that it took place at a time of technological transformation, particularly for navies. Steam is the most obvious example of how navies were changing. Sail power, which had dominated naval warfare since the Spanish Armada, was giving way at last to steam power. There was a big argument between the advocates of steam as to whether paddle wheels or screw propellers were more efficient. But steam was clearly coming into its own. And in a decade before the war broke out, the United States Navy had actually committed itself to the construction of a couple of dozen relatively modern, new steam-powered warships. So the argument could be made that the Union Navy was actually pretty well prepared for a confrontation in April of 1861. It wasn't very big, to be sure. A lot of commentators have acknowledged that there were only about 42 active-duty ships in commission at the time, but most of them were of the most modern type. Now, for the Confederates, it was a different story. The Confederacy had no navy, and there was some hope initially that Southern-born U.S. Navy officers who came over to the Confederacy would bring their ships with them into port, but none did so. What they did instead was take their ships back to the port of origin, resign their commission, and then make their way south by railroad to volunteer their service to the Confederacy. So the only ships the Union had available when the war began were a handful of harbor tugs and a few revenue cutters. So the Confederacy pretty much had to start from scratch.
So where did the Confederacy get their ships then after the war started?
Well, like most of the ships in the Civil War, really on both sides, they had to be converted from other uses. Harbor tugs were armed, civilian ships were reconfigured to bear the weight of guns. Obviously, as the inferior naval power, the Confederacy was more experimental in their efforts, and that's one reason why they were able to take the sunken and sabotaged hull of the USS Merrimack, a steam frigate, raise it from the bottom of the harbor in Hampton Roads and reconfigure it as an ironclad. So creativity was a lot of it. And then, of course, we can probably talk later, if you want to, about the ways the Confederacy managed to get their hands on some ships built in England as well.
Right, right. So basically, they were commandeering private vessels then and on both sides?
Well, commandeering isn't really the right word, but they were making them, they were buying them for the most part. It cost, I think, if I remember the number, about $40,000 each for the Union to buy former merchant ships from people who owned them, and then they would take those ships into a Navy yard and reconvert them, expand the space below decks for more men and for a powder magazine, strengthen the deck so they bear the weight of a naval gun, declare that they were a commissioned warship, and send them off to sea. They weren't particularly effective warships, but since the Navy's principal job in the Civil War, the Union Navy's principal job was blockade, they spent most of their time trying to prevent merchant ships from getting in and out of southern ports, so they were good enough for that.
So you talked a little bit about the blockade. That was the Union's Anaconda plan of General Winfield Scott. Can you kind of give us a little bit more detail on what that idea was and how it was implemented?
Yeah, the Anaconda Plan is a name that was given to it by the people who thought it was a stupid idea. It's not something that Winfield Scott himself ever used. He had written in a letter to George McClellan and had articulated to Abraham Lincoln that the best overall strategy would probably be, in addition to pinning down Confederate armies with a major field force, particularly in Virginia, that the Confederacy could be made to understand its own weakness by blockading the coast and occupying the length of the Mississippi River. So those three elements, a land campaign in Virginia, a blockade off the coast, and the occupation of the Mississippi River, that was at the heart of his overall strategic vision. The term anaconda actually comes from newspaper reporters who thought it was too passive. They wanted Americans, as a rule, are always impatient. They wanted American troops to just charge down in there and take over the Confederacy and give them a good spanking. So the idea of a blockade, which takes months, if not years, to have effect, struck them as too weak. So they called it anaconda after the South American reptile that killed its prey by squeezing it to death, and they meant it to be a derisive term.
So how effective was the blockade overall during the war?
Oh, Bob, that is a great question. I'm not sure I have a definitive answer to that because it all depends on how you measure it. You could say that the Confederacy never lacked for sufficient arms and powder to maintain its armies because they managed to smuggle enough material in through the blockade to keep that war going. That's on one hand. On the other hand, you could point out that the limitation of imported goods contributed greatly to inflation, along with a depression of Confederate currency, so that there was an overall economic impact on the Confederacy that was pretty significant. So to determine whether the blockade worked or did not work depends on how much you want to say that, well, the depression of morale and the economy and circumstances contributed to an overall decline in the Confederacy. In that respect, the blockade mattered. And then one other, too, I will make this point. One of the difficulties the Confederacy had was getting its cash crops to market, particularly cotton. And they not only had trouble importing the goods they needed, they had even more trouble exporting a sufficient amount of cotton to gain the credits overseas that would allow them to purchase more goods. So the blockade did have an impact. It did not shut down the Confederate economy, but it severely weakened it. So in that respect, I think it mattered, and I think it was probably worth the investment.
Do you think that part of the reason that it didn't work probably as well as General Scott wanted it to was lack of vessels on the part of the Union Navy, and also just an unimaginable amount of mileage that they had to blockade with very little ships to do it?
Yeah, I do think that's true. I mean, the Confederate coast is quite lengthy. If you measure it from the Chesapeake Bay, from Virginia all the way around the double coast of Florida down to Matamoros, Mexico on the Rio Grande River, it's 3,500 miles long. And to blockade a coast of that length requires hundreds and hundreds of ships. So while the Union Navy did grow dramatically during the war from that original 42 up to 671, you could say that there were never quite enough ships to close off every single river mouth, harbor inlet, navigable river that the blockade runners could use to bring goods ashore. So it was a cat and mouse game. Even at the very end of the war, in 1865, there were still blockade runners that were managing to sneak through. But the blockade did become more and more efficient as the war went on, so that by 1865, those few vessels getting through the blockade were not enough to sustain its economy.
As the war went on, I'm aware that the supposed neutral British government was actually manufacturing ships for the Confederacy. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that the Confederacy had to start pretty much from scratch. And one of the ways they wanted to get a little bit of a head start here was to get some modern commerce raiding vessels that had been built in England. So Jefferson Davis appointed James Dunwoody Bullock of Georgia, a 38-year-old naval officer, to go to London, and particularly to Liverpool, and to there negotiate with the Trenholm and Company construction firm to build warships for the Confederacy. Now, this is an overt violation of the neutrality laws and a violation of British law as well. But the Trenholm Company were sympathetic, and of course they wanted the business, and Bullock was quite clever in the way he put it together. So their argument was, well, you know, it's not really a warship unless it has guns on it, and there are no guns on this ship, so it's perfectly legitimate, even though everybody knew that the vessels being built were being built for the Confederacy. They would then leave port and go to someplace like the Azores or someplace offshore where the guns would be put on board, and then they would become warships of the Confederate Navy. The CSS Florida, the CSS Alabama, probably the two most famous ships acquired in this way, the Alabama in particular, which conducted a globe-encircling cruise that slaughtered some 64 Union ships. Had in fact been built at the Birkenhead Shipyard opposite Liverpool on the Mersey River. After the war, by the way, the Union complained about this and pointed out to Britain that they had behaved not only not like a neutral, but illegally, and Britain ended up paying a substantial fee to the United States for having conspired in the construction of those ships.
Many do not realize how important the naval wars were for the control of the nation's rivers. What are the important aspects of that story?
Well, we mentioned already about how one component of the Anaconda Plan was control of the Mississippi River. And, of course, rivers were critical throughout the war. This is the first railroad war in history, and railroads were important for transportation. But railroads could be broken. You could burn a bridge. You could rip up rails. There were ways to disrupt railroad communication. But rivers can't be stopped. So the nation's western rivers in particular, the Mississippi, the Ohio, the Cumberland, and the Tennessee, especially, but others as well. And on all of those rivers, he who commanded the river commanded transportation within that military theater. And here again, the Union had a terrific advantage because they had the industrial infrastructure necessary to build specialized warships for the river war. And almost from the very beginning of the war, the confrontation on the rivers turned out to be particularly important in the Western theater.
They also used their gunboats in attacks on some of the major battles along the Mississippi River that supported the Union Army also, didn't they?
They absolutely did. One of the differences here is that because the Confederacy could not compete with the Union in constructing modern warships, particularly iron-armored warships, which, of course, emerge in this war as an important part of naval confrontation, the Confederacy relied heavily on forts. So a lot of the western confrontation near and on the rivers involves Union gunboats attacking Confederate forts, beginning at Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, including Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River, and then, of course, most famously, the Confederate Citadel of Vicksburg.
You talk in your book about three key battles near the end of the war. What were those battles?
Well, by late 1864, the size of the logistic base from which the Confederacy could draw support was shrinking. The Union had taken over much of the coast. They had pushed south along the Mississippi River, broken it in half with the fall of Vicksburg in July of 1863. They'd retaken Tennessee. So that logistic base was getting smaller and smaller, and it was supported by just a very few places, among them Mobile, Alabama, and Wilmington, North Carolina. And I mentioned both of those as important because they helped close down the last open gaps in the blockade and shrink that logistic base even further. And then the third one that I mentioned in that last chapter is the rather remarkable cruise of the CSS Shenandoah, one of the raiding ships that Bullock acquired for the Confederacy in England, that quite literally conducted a circumnavigation of the globe during 1864 and 65, and was in fact the last defiant element of the Confederacy in existence, not hauling down its flag until November of 1865, several months after Appomattox.
So I had a number of kind of things that occurred to me as I'm listening. So I had a few questions. First of all, you know, I suppose at the beginning of the war for Army officers, there was a dynamic of them really having to choose the side that they were going to take for some of them, and it depended on a variety of factors. But for naval officers, you know, who are maybe in command of a ship, how did that dynamic work? Were there instances of naval officers who were taking units from one side to the other, or was it gradual enough that it really that the Navy just divided along regional lines? Like, how did that transition work?
You know, that's a very interesting question. It suggests some of the differences in the culture between the Army and the Navy of the 19th century. The vast majority of Southern-born U.S. Army officers resigned their commissions and went south to fight for their state. State loyalty was perceived by most at the time to supersede national loyalty. The most famous example of this, of course, is Robert E. Lee, who, according to Douglas Southall Freeman, agonized over the question of which side he needed to support and decided that his state came first. There were exceptions to that, of course, in the Army. George Henry Thomas, the Rock of Chickamauga, was as Virginian as Robert E. Lee, and yet he stayed loyal to the Union. So there were a few Southern-born Union generals who stayed by the flag. But by and large, Army officers who were from the South went South. That was not true of Navy officers, interestingly. About a third of Southern-born U.S. Navy officers did go South, Raphael Semmes being a classic example of those. But two-thirds remained by the flag. Two-thirds of Southern-born U.S. Navy officers remained in the U.S. Navy. Now, the explanation for this that I think is probably most pertinent is the fact that U.S. Navy ships tended to serve overseas representing the country rather than in a western fort or a southern fort defending the soil on which they stood. So as a representative of the nation in Brazil or France or the Far China Station, they felt more American than they did Virginian or Alabamian or whatever it might be. So I think that was a factor. A cynic might say, well, there is also the fact that the Union Navy had hundreds of ships and more opportunities for command, and the Confederacy had relatively few of them, so that if you went south, you were not likely to get as good a job. But I'm not quite that cynical. I think the reason was because naval officers tended to identify with the nation more than with the state.
And certainly among Army officers, even when there were differences in, you know, Union and Confederacy, there was still like a sense of, as far as I can tell, a camaraderie or a mutual respect that existed in the Army. Did that transpire to the Navy as well?
It did, but to a lesser extent. You know, there were cases, famous cases, where during a ceasefire, for example, men on opposite sides would come out of the trenches and trade coffee and tobacco and talk about the old days, and former comrades would get together and shake hands and so on. That happened less often at sea. There were very few cases, in fact, where there was what we might call a camaraderie between Confederate and Union naval officers or naval enlisted.
Yeah, and then my final question, I suppose, is, was there a strong presence of a third element at sea? In other words, were there pirates, like free agents, people who were neither Union nor Confederate, who were taking advantage of the situation and kind of being a third presence on the sea?
Yeah, short answer to that is no, but I do want to qualify it by saying this, that there was a tradition in the early part of the 19th century that stretched all the way back to the 18th century of what are called privateers. Privateers are ships that are privately owned, not government ships, not Navy ships, but armed nonetheless. But they could get a certificate from the government in time of war called a letter of marque that authorized them to attack ships belonging to the enemy. And if they captured it, they could keep the ship and anything in it and sell it and keep the proceeds. So, of course, what happened was the people who were victimized by this system called it piracy. It was technically not piracy. And the United States had used it heavily during the American Revolution and the War of 1812 in capturing British ships. The vast majority of British ships captured in both of those wars were taken by privateers. So the Confederacy thought, well, we can do the same thing. Privateering had been declared illegal by the Declaration of Paris in 1856, before the war, but the United States refused to sign the protocol. So technically, privateers were legal. The problem with privateering for the Confederates was that you can only make money off it if you can get your prize back into a port. And with the blockade growing stronger and the refusal of the British or anyone else to allow the Confederates to take prizes into their ports, there was no place the Confederates could take their prizes so they could get their money. And then they also discovered that, in fact, you could make more money, or at least as much money, running the blockade as you could with privateering. And so privateering kind of went away fairly quickly.
So you had Ironsides, you had torpedoes, you had submarines in the American Civil War. What are some of your personal favorite vessels?
Oh my gosh, my personal favorite vessels. Well, I'm kind of a traditionalist. I really think that the ships that the Farragut's Hartford, for example, a steam sloop that he used both in the West Gulf blockading squadron and then used to ascend the Mississippi River, to me, that kind of encapsulates how this war was transitional. It was a ship that looked like a sailing ship. You could hardly distinguish it from the old Ironsides, the frigate from the War of 1812. Tall, soaring masts, wood in the hull, a sharp bow, sailors climbing the rigging. But down inside, there's also a steam engine and rifled guns on the foredeck and on the broadside. So it seems to encapsulate the transition from the Navy in the Age of Sail to a Navy in the Age of Steam. But there are a lot of others. The Monitor, of course, was a transitional vessel of great importance. And, of course, everybody is fascinated by the H.L. Hunley, which was initially a privately owned vessel that came out of Charleston with a volunteer crew, even though the first two volunteer crews had both given up their lives to see if this thing worked. Nevertheless, here's a third crew willing to raise their hand and say, I'll go, to go out and sink a ship off the blockade in Charleston, the first ship sunk by a submarine in combat. So all of those are pertinent and iconic.
Can you tell my listeners to this podcast how they might receive autograph copies of one or more of your books?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm happy to sign books whenever I have an opportunity. So if I'm at an event speaking, by all means, don't be shy. Come up and talk to me. If you're really eager and don't have a chance to get to an event where I'm talking and you want to send me a copy, I'd be happy to sign it and send it back to you. So whichever is your preference.
And how about, do you have any lectures coming up that we can advertise where someone might listen to you speaking?
Well, I'm going to be speaking, let's see, in at the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas in September. I'm going to be speaking at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. in October. Both of those talks are on World War II topics, but I'll sign any book I wrote that you bring me. So
there you go.
Those are a couple of opportunities.
Would you be able to come back next week and speak about another area of your expertise, the leadership of President Abraham Lincoln?
Sure, be happy to do it. Look forward to it.
You are listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. This weekend's events include a living history program both Saturday and Sunday entitled Under Fire, Hold the High Ground, 1862, at Harpers Ferry National Historical Park. Also, living history programs and artillery firings both days will be at Antietam National Battlefield in Sharpsburg, Maryland, and living history demonstrations at Balls Bluff Battlefield Regional Park in Leesburg, Virginia. For those of you in the Danville, Illinois area this weekend, I will be appearing at the Danville Public Library on Friday afternoon at 3, and then both Saturday and Sunday all day as Ward Hill Lemon Lincoln's bodyguard at Arts in the Park. That's in Danville, Illinois. Today's little-known American Civil War fact is this. Famous Americans like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and Grover Cleveland all paid a substitute to serve in their place during the American Civil War. For $300, you could pay to have someone serve in your place. In order to encourage those who were not eligible to enlist to also hire substitutes, President Abraham Lincoln paid 19-year-old J. Summerfield Staples of Pennsylvania $500 to enlist in his place. Today's expression that comes from the American Civil War is this, bark juice. Bark juice was said to be a strong adult beverage, more than likely containing alcohol. Today in American Civil War history, in 1862, General Ulysses S. Grant was ordered to Memphis, Tennessee to become the district commander. Our next week's program, Dr. Craig Simons will return to speak about the leadership of President Abraham Lincoln. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobOConnorBooks.com. I promise I will read every single email. I got another international email. I get excited hearing from international listeners. This one is from Aaron Putnam, who lives in Lviv, L-V-I-V, in Ukraine. Just found your podcast. We listened to the Sultana disaster in the plane and another program on the train. It is really a great podcast. That's really cool. Today's other email, domestic email, includes the following. An email from Roger Barton of Omaha, Nebraska. I was spellbound listening to Jim Taylor talking about slavery and his family. What an amazing story. Thanks for sharing. That was two very amazing programs that I learned a lot from. Another email comes from Beverly Jane Beaverton of Malden, Massachusetts. In reference to your recent program on slavery, I had heard of white slave owners breeding with the slave women, but had never known that slave men were forced to breed with slave women to produce slaves to be sold south. What a remarkable situation. Jim Taylor's two programs were quite eye-opening. Our last email for this week comes from the Sarducci family of Boston, Massachusetts. We have just recently found your pod. It has expanded our understanding of the war. We have some catching up to do, as we have only listened to a few programs. Keep up the great work. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that yesterday was the birthday of West Virginia, the only state that was founded during the Civil War. June 20th, 1863, West Virginia was 155 years old yesterday. Thanks to my ace producer, Mark Guiney, and today's guest, Dr. Craig Simons. Thanks to you for listening. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell those Civil War buffs down the street. We take all comers. Please join us next week, same time, same podcast location, for the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun's low down the sky, Lorena. The frost gleams where the flowers have been.